Just imagine, you've been blindfolded and dropped in a remote corner of the Yorkshire Dales. All you have is a bottle of water, a cagoule, and a compass. Crucially, you also have a map. Your mission is to find the nearest place of habitation. Can you make your destination by nightfall? Well, you will if you follow the scout's mantra. Be prepared. I'm Jerry Broughton, and welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. What makes the podcast special is that listeners are able to follow and look at high-definition images of the maps on oculi-mundi.com. In this podcast, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that's special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. Joining us today, in front of an audience of map lovers here at the British Library, is explorer, adventurer, and Britain's 11th Chief Scout, Dwayne Fields. Dwayne, thanks for joining us. Dwayne was born in Jamaica and grew up in North London. In 2010, he reenacted the journey of Robert Peary and Matthew Henson by walking to the geographic North Pole, which he actually talked about in the first series of the podcast, What's Your Map? So it's great to have you back. On television, he's followed the source of the River Nile with Ben Fogel and navigated Iceland's glaciers with Will Smith. His latest project is a TV series on the impact of mining across Africa. In 2024, he joined a very select group of people to be awarded the title of Chief Scout. It's a group which includes one of the original members of the SAS, Fitzroy MacLean, the TV survivalist Bear Grylls, and the founder of the Scout movement itself, Lord Robert Baden-Powell. I want to just try our audience here. Who, hands up if you were a scout. Any scouts here? Look, we've got quite a
few. Guides as well.
Guides as well. Oh, we've got quite a lot. That's pretty good.
Can I cut in with an interesting stat?
Go for an interesting stat.
One in five of the UK adults were probably a scout or a guide.
And they also include Bob Geldof, David Beckham, and Barack Obama, which I love the idea of the three of them lost in the Lake District. I mean, what happens? Geldof swears, Obama makes a speech. I don't know what Beckham does. I mean, I just think that's such a great connection of three people. Dwayne is joined here today to talk about some very secret maps. And he's joined by Caroline Pantling, who's head of heritage services at the Scouts UK, based at their headquarters near Epping Forest. She also volunteers with her local scout group.
Of which David Beckham was a cub. The mighty 23rd Chingford Scout Group.
Oh, now I know where this conversation's going to go. So, based on that, I'm going to, of course, ask Dwayne to begin, and Caroline is going to be talking with Dwayne, to ask, what's your map that you've brought today, Dwayne?
So, the map I've brought today is a map that was drawn by Robert Baden-Powell, Lord Robert Baden-Powell himself. Now, looking at this, first of all, you can probably just see a butterfly, right? But if you look a little bit closer, you can see the outline of the fortress in the top right-hand corner. It's just on the outside of the... I'm just going to use the pointer. Here we go. So this outline here, just around the thorax of the butterfly, matches the outline or the outer walls of the fortress. Now, as we all know, a good map needs a good key. In this instance, we've got fortress guns. So this here's a really big fortress guns. These are the big ones that's built into the cement of the fortress itself. You've got two of these right there. You've got these field guns. So you'll recognize these because they've got big wheels and you can drag them around from one place to another. And you've got smaller machine guns. Now, what Robert Baden-Powell did in this map is he's illustrated these with a blob. It looks like that. So you've got one here and one here. And you know it represents the big fortress guns because of this line. It sits on this line, which tells you the position it would be in the fortress. And that's where he's hidden the information in the image of the butterfly. Now, if we move over to the machine guns, he's represented the machine guns as two dots. And what he's done here is he's done a line leading to where it would be in the fortress. and he's put the two dots either side of the line, and he's repeated that again here. So you can see the two dots there with the line going in, and we can see a fortress, a machine gun there. The field guns, that's this one here and this one here. Again, he's represented those with a kind of a blob, but that's on the lines themselves. So you can see it sits on the line, and if you follow it, it goes into where it would be sat in the fortress itself, just represented by this line outside the butterfly's main body, but within the wings. And I think it's a really clever way of doing exactly what scouts do. We're using something that you might find in everyday life. As scouts, we use bottles to make toys or to make something we can filter water with. In this instance, Robert Baden-Powell said, actually, I'm going to use a drawing of a butterfly to hide a map. Was this a real map? Was this a real representation of a fortress? Did he really go and gather this information himself? I'm going to leave it to you to tell us.
Because this is, I mean, people are looking at this. I mean, I remember when I first saw it, I went, what? But it's a butterfly. I mean, talk about secret maps. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. It took me some time. Caroline, tell us a little bit more about what is this showing? What is the depiction of the fort? And give us the context here for Baden-Powell drawing this incredible secret map.
Yeah, so Baden-Powell was a very talented artist, so it's sort of a natural for him to use one of his natural talents to secretly convey information. What's interesting is that he does this in his role as an intelligence officer during his army career. He has progressed to the rank of captain, and he's looking for the next way to progress his army career. Luckily, there's some family contacts, and he is able to pull on the relationship with his maternal uncle, who has just been given the role of Commander of Chief of Malta. And he, whilst he's there, he's mostly in charge of organising his uncle's social life, organising lots of balls, entertainments. This isn't really the stuff that appeals to a career soldier. He doesn't want to be behind the desk. He wants to be out doing. So he does persuade his uncle to give him the role of intelligence officer. This is not a spy in the way we might think of today. It's more going out, observing fortifications, making notes, reporting back. This isn't sort of the James Bond style spy that we might imagine.
But also, not only do you have butterflies, but you have leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Dwayne, just tell us a little bit about what's going on here, and then we'll talk more about why he goes from butterflies to leaves.
Again, what's interesting here is Baden-Powell's used something that's quite common, something that you'd overlook. And if you looked at this leaf by itself without seeing any other part of the image, it would just look like a leaf, right? But let's look a little bit closer. Just here, the main spine or the main vein of the leaf, if we follow it, it goes along, it goes up, up, further along, up, across, down, with a little hump, and then it goes off. If we look down here at what represents the hillside, we've got a gun and another gun, which is represented right here. And then we've got this really big, the peak of the hillside with two guns. Again, the peak of the hillside. But if we look at where the guns are in reference to the leaf and we follow that spine, they are represented by this. So what he's cleverly done here is instead of drawing what he's seen, he's drawn it, but he's also changed it slightly so he could read it, but no one else could. And if you follow each of these veins, you notice there's a blob. I'm going to call it a blob, a little mark that represents each gun. Again, if you haven't seen this image side by side with that, you wouldn't know what you're looking at. There's even other blobs, we're going to call them that for now, in this leaf just to throw off anyone who's looking at it, because I'm not sure these represent anything. The only ones that represent a gun, in this instance, a machine gun, are the ones that follows a vein back to where they would be on the map. There's also something really interesting here. There are two dots standing side by side on the line, and these show where there could be a dead space, somewhere you could hide, get cover. And we can see it just here. So I think that represents a space here where you're out of sight of the guns. And I think, again, it's a really clever way of hiding something in a map. It's a very inventive, imaginative way of doing it, and that's very much the scout spirit. Be inventive, find a way, find a solution. Use your imagination and use what's around you.
Caroline, can we go a bit deeper into the production of these maps and how he's drawing them, where they're being published, and more of the context about his life and why these come about? Tell us a bit more about them.
Yes, yeah, so both of these maps appear in a book written by Baden-Powell called My Adventures as a Spy. And by this point, he is a well-known figure. He's made his name through his army career. He's returned to the UK, decided he wants to look at working with the youth movement. He does time observing what the Boys' Brigade are doing as part of their honorary team, and visits them. But he thinks he can come up with something that engages young people more. He really believes in the power of imagination as a learning tool. What he wants is to give young people the opportunity to use their own initiative rather than becoming sort of automatons that follow orders. And he thinks this is will be good for them, but also good for Great Britain. So he takes work that he's done before, his little book, Aids to Scouting, takes some of the ideas for that and comes up with the idea of a scouting programme and publishes Scouting for Boys. This isn't originally going to be a movement of its own right. The idea, it's like a curriculum that volunteers with the Boys' Brigade or YMCA or church groups, Jewish lads, schools, they can use it to facilitate activities through a programme called Scouting. It's only when this is met with such overwhelming enthusiasm by young people of Great Britain that he decides after a few weeks he's going to have the Scout movement as its own entity.
But he's a kind of polarising figure, isn't he? Because tell us a bit about his military experience, and he's involved in the siege of Mafeking. But also, in a way, that makes him not necessarily popular with the army. Is that right? Is that his move out of, as it were, that strict military space into the scouting and this kind of work? Tell me the context there and how that's happened.
Yeah, so he ends up as the commanding officer for the British Army during the siege of Mafeking, which takes place during the Second Boer War in 1899-1900. And he comes under a lot of criticism from his peers within the army. They don't believe that he should have ended up in a siege situation. However, at this point, there have been very few successes for the British Army. And so this little force of British soldiers is really hyped up in the press. And he becomes a very well-known figure. He was very good at making himself stand out. He made alterations to the British Army uniform, which maybe didn't go down quite so well.
Like what? What did he do?
If you can imagine the old campaign hat that scouts used to wear until 1966, he finds out about this through an American officer, Frederick Burnham, who wears a campaign hat, and Baden-Powell adopts this as part of his personal style. So if you're looking at a photo of lots of British Army officers, you can spot him. He stands out. He's also become a published author, not least because his army pay is not enough to support his mother, who was widowed when Baden-Powell was only 3 years old, and his unmarried sister. He needs to send money back to support the family as well as supporting himself. And so by publishing books, this is able to do this, and he carries on that. But so the siege of Mafeking is lifted, and this is met with huge relief in Britain, across the British Empire. Mafeking Day is celebrated. To mafic becomes a word in British vocabulary, saying to celebrate sort of joyously in public. So he becomes hugely well known, and this influence is critical to the success of the Scouts and the launch of that. So when this person who is, you know, portrayed at the time as a British hero, although there are challenges within his narrative, it does mean that it really captures the imagination of his target audience to join in with something that he'd done.
And you've got the books. I just want to ask you about the books in a minute. But just as you've kind of given us a context for Baden-Powell, Duane, I wonder how you see yourself in relation to that history of the emergence of the Scouts under Baden-Powell and the kind of figure he is. How do you see yourself in relation to him? I mean, what's your sense of the man and where you see the Scouts in contrast to where he was with them when they were first founded?
Well, that's a really good question. You can imagine it's a question I get asked. It takes a different shape every time, but the question remains broadly the same. I am the legacy of what Baden-Powell started in 1907. I am. We have 500,000 or so young people that meet every single week from every different background, class, colour, creed, every country, almost every country in the world, in fact. We are the legacy. And if you think back to the very first group, it was a mixed group of young people from, I think it was across from Poole Harbour, all the way to London. I think there are people that said it was private school kids and public school kids. Well, in actual fact, I'm not sure if that's quite accurate, and you'll probably be able to give me some more information on that in a minute or share that with us. But it was always about mixing people from different places and different, backgrounds in life. I think my sitting as Chief Scout is proof that scouting works, and it's proof that the plan for scouting is coming to pass now. Scouting was about bringing every single body along a journey, something that would improve your life, improve your community, improve your future prospects. And that's exactly what it's been doing for the past 118 or so years. Where I sit, I'm so proud of what we do in the Scout movement. I was a young cub. I stepped away from scouting, and that's some of the time that I was really wayward. When I found scouting again as an adult and I joined up as an ambassador, I felt like I was going home. I felt like I was going back to something really familiar, something that was really good for society, something that was positive for young people, and something that was meant to do good in the world. And we know it does do good in the world, as you listed a number of the people of note who have been scouts in the past. Mm. We've got astronauts. We've got people who landed on the moon. We've got doctors, nurses, you name it, we have that or had that in the scout movement. And I'm really proud of it. And I'm so proud that Baden-Powell did follow through, build the scout movement, spend 36 years as chief scout. My challenge now, and I'm going to share this because I'm going to take every opportunity I can to shout about this. In the scout movement, we have 107,000 young people waiting to join, which is incredible. They're waiting to join a group. And the one barrier, we can't keep up with demand in regards to our volunteers. We need more adult volunteers. So if anyone in here has a few minutes, please consider donating or giving it to us. But my point here is we are in a huge amount of demand. Like I said, 500,000 young people every single week. We can double that if we work really hard. And when I step down from my role as Chief Scout, I want to have reduced that waiting list. That's my aim. Fundamentally, I'm proud of this movement, and I will shout it from the rooftops.
And this whole thing about the mixing of different groups and classes, and you mentioned this is part of what Baden-Powell was about, and this is the Brown Sea experiment, I think, isn't it, that you might be able to tell us more about, Caroline. What's the Brown Sea experiment?
So throughout sort of 1906, 1907, Baden-Powell is taking his military manual, Aids to Scouting, which he knows has been used by different youth groups and schools because it's got practical fun ideas for learning. And he is converting and taking out quite a lot of the military references and replacing them with activities and ideas inspired by explorers and frontiersmen, and making it more appealing to that age group. But he wants to test out these ideas. So he takes 20 boys with some other helpers to Brownsea Island in Poole Harbour. And they are 10 boys who come from the local Poole and Bournemouth Boys Brigade, where he has contacts because he's been supporting them, and 10 boys who attend fee-paying public schools, most of them are the sons of army officer friends. And they have this camp on Brownsea Island, and he mixes them up. Those of you who have been part of scouting and guiding will know about the patrol system and having patrol leaders. So it's all about teamwork and peer leadership. And the boys are mixed up in these groups and given the opportunity to just be together and very present in that, and not sort of leaving behind the very rigid social constructs of the Edwardian world. And I think it is even supersedes his ideas. What he does do later, and this will relate to a bit of the narrative later on, is unfortunately the boys from Poole and Bournemouth get a little bit written out of the narrative, because when he is writing Scouting for Boys and talking about it later, he talks about taking boys from the East End of London, because it makes a better narrative, and putting them together with boys from public school
boys from the East End of London.
So yes, one to definitely be able to embellish the story to make a good narrative.
And the just returning quickly to the maps as well, because the books that you brought them in here, My Adventures as a Spy. He is interesting as a writer because of how he keeps, I guess you'd say, refashioning himself and telling different stories and his involvement in spying and secrecy. You brought them here. Just tell us a little bit about the fact that we've got two versions of the book. Why is that?
Yeah, so, I mean, bringing two books to the British Library does slightly feel like Colston Newcastle. So we have the 1915 version. I'll just open up, but I'll describe. So at the front page, it does say, My Adventures as a Spy. It has a picture of the butterfly and talks about the fact that you can find more information about this on page 52. And he starts writing this book in October 1914. When he writes to his publishers and says he wants to write a book about spying based on some of his own experiences. The interesting bit is that in the book, he talks about the fact that he is in the Balkans and he is doing fortress observations, and he wants to disguise the fact that that's what he's doing. So he takes on the role of an entomologist, butterfly collector, and is doing these drawings and sketches. And in amongst these, he hides these pictures of butterflies with pictures of forts. What he actually does here is that he's taking two different aspects of his life. He did go to the Balkans, but he went on a cycling holiday. however, he also did do fortress observations, and we know he disguised the maps he created in the Wings of Butterflies, and that was whilst he was an intelligence officer in Malta in the 1890s. So I think what he does is combine these two experiences. So he starts writing this October 1914. I'm not sure how many people in earlier 1914 would be able to pinpoint the Balkans on a map. However, it's 1914. We've just had the assassination in Sarajevo. Suddenly, everybody knows where this is. And so it's a useful opportunity for him to go, oh, well, I've been there. I know what that's like. I've also done this thing. That makes a really good story, and merges the two experiences to make a better story. However, slightly further down the line, when he's becoming increasingly well-known, people are starting to go, oh, we should really write a biography of the founder of the Scout movement. This is fantastic. And he suddenly gets a bit nervous about the fact that people are going to be looking into regimental diaries and records and things and going, wait a minute, you were in Malta on that date and you weren't there. And some of the stories don't quite hang together. So when we look at the 1924 edition, the title has changed to The Adventures of a Spy. So slightly distancing himself from the idea that this has been written as an autobiography of his adventures, and it's more of a fiction with some inspiration from his personal experiences.
And we raise the maps again, and I wonder, Dwayne, what's the current way in which maps are being used in the Scouts? Because I guess we've been looking at this exhibition and thinking how maps increasingly are going online and more virtual, and people are worried, I think, in many ways about how people aren't using paper maps to relate to the landscape. What's going on with the Scouts and mapping?
So one of the things that we try and do within the Scout movement is get young people outside more often. And the best way you can do that and make them feel comfortable is by allowing them to read the map and attribute what they're seeing on paper to what they're seeing in the landscape, or vice versa. So we spend a lot of our time within the Scout movement teaching young people how to read maps. And it's something that Baden-Powell actually was really good at, because he taught others within the military how to read maps as well. And so that's definitely a carryover from the times of Baden-Powell. It's really important that you know how to read a map, especially if you're going to spend time outdoors. One, because you need to know what kind of terrain you're going to be crossing. It sets you up to know how long it's going to take you to cover a certain distance, how much food and kit and gear you'll need. It's also important because it's a great way to bring people together. If you see people hiking, huddled around a map, they're sharing ideas, sharing experiences, and maps tell you so much more than maybe just looking out onto the landscape. You can see what's beyond your line of sight as well. And I think it's important when you're trying to get young people in particular to be comfortable in a particular environment that they have some idea of what's coming. We all know when we want to keep our young people on edge, we say, no, we're going to the shops, don't worry. And for the next 2 hours while you're driving to the shops, but what shop are we going to? Yeah, but what are we going to get? Yeah, but am I going to get lunch? Am I going to eat? Is there going to be food there? That's what I do when I want to really throw my kids off. But when I want them to be comfortable and to have an input, and to get some confidence and feel confident about what we're about to do, what we're about to see, what we're about to experience, I show them, I tell them, and I give them a real clear idea. And that's exactly what a map does. When you, you know, you plan to go to Lake District, bring a map, you check the weather. The map tells you what you're going to see, where you're going to see it, and also it tells you if you've gone wrong. If you're walking along, you're expecting to be handrailing a river, and all of a sudden you're like, hold on, there's some crags over there, there's a hillside over there, there's no river. You know you've gone wrong. So it's a good indicator as well. So fundamentally, it's about giving you the confidence to spend time in an environment where you have some familiarity with prior to going there.
And Baden-Powell has this great line, doesn't he? He says, don't just give people a map, give them a mystery. Mm. What is the mystery that he's interested in there in relation to maps?
There's a couple of ways of looking at that. If you give somebody a mystery, if I handed that to you, you could sit and think and dwell on that for a long time and you can build up all your own ideas. If you have a map and the if you're given, you know, carte blanche to go off and create your own maps, you can create something like this. It gives you a chance to use your imagination, and that's what we encourage our young people to do. Alternatively, if I gave you a physical map in your hand, you can go out and create your own adventures from that. And I think it's something along that line.
Which is a wonderful way to really ask you, as we sort of come to an end, really, is what next for the Scouts? And for both of you, what do you see happening with the future of the Scouts? And also, Dwayne, you've talked a little bit about your sense of where you want to take them, but what is the future?
I'll let you go first, actually.
I think it's very much about responding to the needs of young people. And the Scouts has always evolved as a movement. It's one of the reasons we're a movement. We don't stand still. We constantly move and evolve. And that was something that Baden-Powell said. That's why he'd chosen that particular word. So I think as our lives constantly change, it's about being responsive. For instance, we know that a lot more young people in the aftermath of the pandemic are dealing with mental health issues. So being able to provide programs and spaces where they feel supported and so that you can create those bonds with friends and be able to build on their potential, and particularly young people who maybe struggle more in the classroom, as Baden-Powell did himself. You know, one of his school reports says, has fundamentally given up the study of mathematics, which, quite frankly, I can get on board with. But, you know, being able to support young people who maybe don't thrive in the classroom, have got additional needs, and be able to reach out and support them is critical. And I see that in my role as having been a cub leader and now volunteering with the Beaver Scout section. The impact and the aftermath of the pandemic is very much still being felt, and being able to be there for those young people and support those, giving them the opportunities, but also our volunteers, you know, to be able to be part of that network of volunteers, it's amazing. And there have been Tuesday evenings where I'm like, oh gosh, I've just had a really long day at work. I've been thinking about Scouts all day and now I've got to go and actually do it. But you come out with that buzz at the end of it. And that sense, it's a different team that I work, you know, I volunteer with. You suddenly see a young person have a breakthrough or succeed at something they didn't think they could do. And that sense of, it's not just their achievement, you feel a sense of achievement for yourself.
Dwayne, I mean, you've said a little bit about what you want to aspire to in terms of your tenure, but anything else in terms of how you see the Scouts developing?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a parallel there again between myself and Baden-Powell. My maths teacher said, Dwayne, the best you're going to achieve in life is a short prison sentence. which was a brilliantly phrased term or a brilliantly worded phrase. But look at me now, sir. I think what I see and hope for the Scout movement is, again, to bring that waiting list down, to open up new groups in areas that have never had groups or HQs open before, to get more people from more diverse backgrounds to come back into the movement or to join the movement for the first time. We are an incredible movement. We span borders. We're found in pretty much every region in the world. The Scout movement supports other Scouts in Ukraine. We had Scouts from Egypt and the surrounding region at a recent jamboree in Norfolk just over the summer. We need their lives to carry on. We need to bridge the gaps that they might find in their own communities. And I think scouting is a great way to do it. When you invite a community that might feel marginalized for one reason or the other into a jamboree, it's a place where they can actually say, well, what I've been told or heard about you It's not quite true, is it? And they build their bridges, and that's how we're going to, you know, formulate a better, stronger, more connected society going forward.
And that's what was always part of Baden-Powell's ethos. I mean, you know, the first World Scout Jamboree in 1920, he talks about bringing young people from different cultures, different backgrounds, different faiths, different areas of the world together. And he has, and particularly in the aftermath of the First World War, which, I mean, given someone, he was a career soldier, the industrialised nature of the First World War he finds highly shocking. And whilst he's always talked about the Scouts as being a peace movement, and he's very keen to say we are peace Scouts, not military Scouts, this idea about bringing young people together to get to know your fellow Scout, to understand, yes, you might have differences, but you also have commonalities, is always part of that narrative. And that's the importance we still have our huge international events organised at world level, but also nationally as well, which still does that and enables those conversations to happen and to find out about other people.
Thanks to Duane Fields and to Caroline Pantling for joining us on this special live edition of What's Your Map at the British Library. There are lots of past episodes for you to enjoy, to delve into the catalogue, scan the QR code on the screen, or search What's Your Map on the podcast platform of your choice. For me, for now, it's goodbye until next time. Thank you all for coming. I hope you've enjoyed the day.